Inside Facebook, few people noticed my TED Talk, and those who did responded positively. But outside of Facebook, the criticism started to roll in. One of my colleagues from Treasury called to say that others, not him, of course, were wondering why I gave more speeches on women's issues than on Facebook. I had been at the company for 2.5 years and given countless speeches on rebuilding marketing around the social graph and exactly one speech on gender. Someone else asked me, "So is this your thing now?" At the time, I didn't know how to respond. Now I would say yes. I made this my thing because we need to disrupt the status quo. Staying quiet and fitting in may have been all the first generations of women who entered corporate America could do. In some cases, it might still be the safest path. But this strategy is not paying off for women as a group. Instead, we need to speak out, identify the barriers that are holding women back, and find solutions. The response to my TED Talk showed me that addressing these issues openly can make a difference. Women forwarded the video to their friends, colleagues, daughters, and sisters. I began receiving emails and letters from women all over the world who wanted to share their stories of how they gained the courage to reach for more opportunities, sit at more tables, and believe more in themselves. One of my favorite letters came from Sabine Virani, a consultant in Dubai and the only woman in an office of more than 300 employees. She responded to my story about the executive who could not point me to the women's bathroom because, as she explained, in her workplace, the women's bathroom did not even exist. Sabine described how during her first week on the project, the client took her team out to dinner, but she couldn't join because the restaurant didn't allow women. Talk about not sitting at the table. She couldn't even get into the restaurant. Some of the men were openly hostile to Sabine. Others just ignored her. But rather than give up and transfer to a friendlier office, she decided that she could demonstrate to everyone that women are competent professionals. In the end, she won her coworkers over, and the client converted a bathroom into a women's bathroom just for her. She sent me a photo of her standing in front of a door with a printed sign that read simply and powerfully, "Toilets for women only." It was also enormously gratifying that men reacted positively to the talk, too. Dr. John Probosco of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine told me that my story about women being more reluctant than men to raise their hands rang true for him, so he decided to do away with the old hand-raising system during rounds. Instead, he started calling on male and female students evenly. He quickly realized that the women knew the answers just as well, or even better, than the men. In one day, he increased female participation. By making one small change to his behavior, he changed a much larger dynamic. Major changes can result from these kinds of nudge techniques, small interventions that encourage people to behave in slightly different ways at critical moments. The simple act of talking openly about behavioral patterns makes the subconscious conscious. For example, Google has an unusual system where engineers nominate themselves for promotions. And the company found that men nominated themselves more quickly than women. The Google management team shared this data openly with the female employees, and women's self-nomination rates rose significantly, reaching roughly the same rates as men's. All the feedback from TED convinced me that I should keep speaking up and encouraging others to do the same. It is essential to breaking the logjam. Talking can transform minds, which can transform behaviors, which can transform institutions. I know it isn't easy. Anyone who brings up gender in the workplace is wading into deep and muddy waters. The subject itself presents a paradox, forcing us to acknowledge differences while trying to achieve the goal of being treated the same. Women, especially those at junior levels, worry that raising gender issues makes them appear unprofessional or as if they are blaming others. I have listened to women vent frustration over being undervalued and even demeaned on a daily basis at work. When I ask if they have aired any of these complaints to their superiors, they've responded, "Oh no, I couldn't." There is so much fear that speaking up will make the situation worse or even result in being penalized or fired. It seems safer to bear the injustice. For men, raising this subject can be even harder. A male friend who runs a large organization once confided in me, "It's easier to talk about your sex life in public than to talk about gender." The fact that he wouldn't go on record with this quote shows he meant it. Vittorio Colao, CEO of Vodafone, told me that he showed my TED Talk to his senior management team because he shares my belief that women sometimes hold themselves back. He also believed this message was easier to hear from a woman than a man. His point is valid. If a man had delivered the same message or even gently pointed out that women might be taking actions that limited their options, he would have been pilloried. Shutting down discussion is self-defeating and impedes progress. We need to talk and listen and debate and refute and instruct and learn and evolve. And since the majority of managers are men, we need them to feel comfortable addressing these issues directly with female employees. When a woman sits on the side of a room, a man needs to be able to wave her over to the table and explain why, so she will know to sit at the table the next time. Ken Chenault, CEO of American Express, is a leader on this front. Ken openly acknowledges that in meetings, both men and women are more likely to interrupt a woman and give credit to a man for an idea first proposed by a woman. When he witnesses either of these behaviors, he stops the meeting to point it out. Coming from the top, this really makes employees think twice. A more junior woman or man can also intervene in the situation when a female colleague has been interrupted. She can gently but firmly tell the group, "Before we move on, I'd like to hear what senior woman had to say." This action not only benefits the senior woman, but can raise the stature of the junior woman as well, since speaking up for someone else displays both confidence and a communal spirit. The junior woman comes across as both competent and nice. At Facebook, I teach managers to encourage women to talk about their plans to have children and help them continue to reach for opportunities. I give men the option of quoting me if the words don't feel right coming out of their mouths. Still, this approach is a bit of a crutch, and it does not translate to other companies. It would be preferable if everyone had permission to talk about this subject, both publicly and behind closed office doors. One stumbling block is that many people believe that the workplace is largely a meritocracy, which means we look at individuals, not groups, and determine that differences in outcomes must be based on merit, not gender. Men at the top are often unaware of the benefits they enjoy simply because they're men, and this can make them blind to the disadvantages associated with being a woman. Women lower down also believe that men at the top are entitled to be there, so they try to play by the rules and work harder to advance rather than raise questions or voice concerns about the possibility of bias. As a result, everyone becomes complicit in perpetuating an unjust system. At the same time, we must be careful not to inject gender into every discussion. I know a male CEO who is enormously dedicated to hiring and promoting women. When a female employee kicked off a negotiation by insisting that she should have a higher title and was underleveled because she was a woman, it immediately put him on the defense. She was speaking her truth, but in this case, her truth was an accusation with legal ramifications. As soon as she framed the issue in those terms, the CEO had no choice but to put their friendly talks on hold and call in HR. It might have served her better to explain how she was contributing to the company and ask for the promotion first. Even today, mentioning gender in work situations often makes people visibly uncomfortable. To their credit, Many institutions have worked hard to sensitize people to these issues, especially sexual harassment. But while human resources seminars can raise consciousness and help protect employees, they have also raised the specter of legal action, which can create real barriers to these conversations. The federal and state laws that are designed to protect employees against discrimination specify only that an employer cannot make decisions based on certain protected characteristics, such as gender, pregnancy, and age. But companies usually take the policy a step further and teach managers not to ask anything related to these areas. Anyone making even a benign inquiry, such as, "Are you married?" or "Do you have kids?" can later be accused of basing a personnel decision on this information. As a result, a manager who is trying to help a female employee by pointing out a gender-driven style difference could be charged with discrimination for doing so. The first time I asked a prospective employee if she was considering having children soon, I understood that doing so could expose me and my company to legal risk. Unlike many women, I was in a position to evaluate that risk and chose to take it. The laws that protect women and minorities and people with disabilities, among others, from discrimination are essential, and I am not suggesting they be circumvented. But I have also witnessed firsthand how they can have a chilling effect on discourse, sometimes even to the detriment of the people they are designed to defend. I don't have a solution to this dilemma, and will leave it to public policy and legal experts to solve. I do think this is worth some serious attention, so we can find a way to deal with these issues in a way that protects but doesn't suppress. Most people would agree that gender bias exists in others. We, however, would never be swayed by such superficial and unenlightened opinions. Except we are. Our preconceived notions about masculinity and femininity influence how we interact with and evaluate colleagues in the workplace. A 2012 study found that when evaluating identical resumes for a lab manager position from a male student and a female student, scientists of both sexes gave better marks to the male applicant. Even though the students had the same qualifications and experience, the scientists deemed the female student less competent and offered her a lower starting salary and less mentoring. Other studies of job applicants, candidates for scholarships, and musicians auditioning for orchestras have come to the same conclusion. Gender bias influences how we view performance, and typically raises our assessment of men while lowering our assessment of women. Even today, gender-blind evaluations still result in better outcomes for women. Unfortunately, most jobs require face-to-face interviews. All of us, myself included, are biased, whether we admit it or not. And thinking that we are objective can actually make this even worse, creating what social scientists call a bias blind spot. This blind spot causes people to be too confident about their own powers of objectivity, so that they fail to correct for bias. When evaluating identically described male and female candidates for the job of police chief, respondents who claimed to be the most impartial actually exhibited more bias in favor of male candidates. This is not just counterproductive, but deeply dangerous. Evaluators in that same study actually shifted hiring criteria to give men an advantage. When a male applicant possessed a strong educational record, that quality was considered critical to the success of a police chief. But when a male applicant possessed a weaker educational record, that quality was rated as less important. This favoritism was not shown to female applicants. If anything, the reverse happened. When a woman possessed a particular skill, ability, or background, that quality tended to carry less weight. The infuriating takeaway from this study is that merit can be manipulated to justify discrimination. Social scientists are uncovering new examples of bias all the time. In 2012, a series of studies compared men in more modern marriages, whose wives worked outside the home full-time, to men in more traditional marriages, whose wives worked at home. The researchers wanted to determine if a man's home arrangement affected his professional behavior. It did. Compared to men in modern marriages, men in more traditional marriages viewed the presence of women in the workforce less favorably. They also denied promotions to qualified female employees more often and were more likely to think that companies with a higher percentage of female employees ran less smoothly. The researchers speculated that men in traditional marriages are not overtly hostile toward women, but instead are benevolent sexists, holding positive yet outdated views about women. Another term I have heard is nice guy misogynists. These men might even believe that women have superior strengths in certain areas, like moral reasoning, which makes them better equipped to raise children, and perhaps less equipped to succeed in business. In all likelihood, men who share this attitude are unaware of how their conscious and unconscious beliefs hurt their female colleagues. Another bias arises from our tendency to want to work with people who are like us. Innovisor, a consulting firm, conducted research in 29 countries and found that when men and women select a colleague to collaborate with, both were significantly more likely to choose someone of the same gender. Yet, diverse groups often perform better. Armed with this information, managers should take a more active role in mixing and matching when assigning teams. Or, at the very least, managers should point out this tendency to give employees the motivation to shake things up. My own attempts to point out gender bias have generated more than my fair share of eye-rolling from others. At best, people are open to scrutinizing themselves and considering their blind spots. At worst, they become defensive and angry. One common instance of bias crops up during job performance evaluations. When reviewing a woman, the reviewer will often voice the concern, while she's really good at her job, she's just not as well liked by her peers. When I hear language like that, I bring up the Heidi Howard study and how success and likability are negatively correlated for women. I ask the evaluator to consider the possibility that this successful female may be paying a gender-based penalty. Usually, people find the study credible, nodding their heads in agreement, but then bristle at the suggestion that this might be influencing the reaction of their management team. They will further defend their position by arguing that it cannot be gender-related because, aha, both men and women have problems with that particular female executive. But the success and likability penalty is imposed by both men and women. Women perpetuate this bias as well. Of course, not every woman deserves to be well-liked. Some women are disliked for behaviors that they would do well to change. In a perfect world, they would receive constructive feedback and the opportunity to make those changes. Still, calling attention to this bias forces people to think about whether there is a real problem or a perception problem. The goal is to give women something men tend to receive automatically, the benefit of the doubt. In turn, women might also want to give their bosses the benefit of the doubt. Cynthia Hogan served as chief counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee under then-Senator Joe Biden before leaving in 1996 after her first child was born. Her plan was to return to the workforce a few years later, but when her second child was born prematurely, those plans changed. A full 12 years later, Vice President-elect Biden called Cynthia to ask her to join his staff as chief legal counsel in the White House. "My first reaction was that I no longer owned any clothes other than yoga pants," Cynthia said. But her larger concern was whether she could manage the long hours in the White House and still see her family. She put it beautifully. "I knew that whether this would work depended on two men. So first I asked my husband if he could step in and take on more of the responsibility for the kids. He said, 'Of course, it's your turn.' And then I told the vice president-elect that I really wanted to have dinner with my kids most nights. And his response was, "Well, you have a phone, and I can call you when I need you after dinner time." Cynthia believes that the lesson of her story is, don't be afraid to ask, even if it seems like a long shot. Being offered a senior job, especially after being at home for so long, presented a great opportunity. Many women would have accepted it without even trying to carve out the time they needed for their families. Others would have turned it down, assuming that having dinner at home most nights was not negotiable. Being forthright led to opportunity. Every job will demand some sacrifice. The key is to avoid unnecessary sacrifice. This is especially hard since our work culture values complete dedication. We worry that even mentioning other priorities makes us less valuable employees. I have faced this too. As I described, once I had children, I changed my working hours to be home for dinner. But only fairly recently did I start talking about this change. And while the impact of my actually leaving work early was negligible, admitting that I went home at 5:30 turned out to be kind of a big deal. I first openly discussed my office hours at the launch of Facebook Women, an in-house resource group. The initial meeting, run by Lori Goller and Facebook's head of engineering, Mike Schrepfer, was open to any Facebook employee, including men. During the Q&A, I was asked the inevitable question about how I balanced my job and family. I talked about leaving work to have dinner with my children, and then getting back online after they went to bed. I said that I was sharing my schedule because I wanted to encourage others to personalize their schedules too. Even though I had planned in advance to discuss this, I felt nervous. Years of conditioning had taught me never to suggest that I was doing anything other than giving 100% to my job. It was scary to think that someone, even people working for me, might doubt my diligence or dedication. Fortunately, it didn't happen. A few people at Facebook thanked me for mentioning it, but that was it. A few years later, producer Dylan McGee interviewed me for her Makers video series. We spoke on a wide range of subjects, including my daily work schedule. The video was posted to the web and was instantly the subject of heated debate. Thanks to social media, serves me right, everyone had an opinion about my leaving the office at 5:30. I got flowers with an anonymous thank you note. Mike Callahan, Yahoo's general counsel at the time, told me that several of the more senior women in his legal department said my admission struck a chord and they were going to follow my example. Author Ken Auletta said that I could not have gotten more headlines if I had murdered someone with an axe. While I was glad to jumpstart the discussion, all the attention gave me this weird feeling that someone was going to object and fire me. I had to reassure myself that this was absurd. Still, the clamor made me realize how incredibly hard it would be for someone in a less senior position to ask for or admit to this schedule. We have a long way to go before flex time is accepted in most workplaces. It will only happen if we keep raising the issue. The discussions may be difficult, but the positives are many. We cannot change what we are unaware of, and once we are aware, we cannot help but change. Even a well-established institution like Harvard Business School, HBS, can evolve rapidly when issues are addressed head-on. Historically at HBS, American male students have academically outperformed both female and international students. When Nitin Noria was appointed dean in 2010, he made it his mission to close this gap. He began by appointing Youngmi Moon as Senior Associate Dean of the MBA program, the first woman to hold that position in the school's century-plus history. He also created a new position for Robin Ely, an expert on gender and diversity. Associate Dean Moon, working with Professor Francis Fry, spent the first year rigorously examining the school's culture. They visited each classroom and discussed the challenges women and international students faced. Then they used that knowledge to create what Dean Noria calls a level of mindfulness. Without calling for major overhauls, they tackled the soft stuff. Small adjustments students could make immediately, like paying more attention to the language they used in class. They laid out a new communal definition of leadership. Leadership is about making others better as a result of your presence and making sure that impact lasts in your absence. They held students responsible for the impact their behavior had on others. Those who violated that principle, or even hosted an event where that principle was violated, were held accountable. The second year, HBS introduced small group projects to encourage collaboration between classmates who would not naturally work together. They also added a year-long field course, which plays to the strengths of students who are less comfortable contributing in front of large classes. By commencement, the performance gap had virtually disappeared. Men, women, and international students were represented proportionally in the honors awarded. There was another benefit, too. In a result many considered surprising, overall student satisfaction went up, not just for the female and international students, but for American males as well. By creating a more equal environment, everyone was happier. And all of this was accomplished in just 2 short years. Social gains are never handed out. They must be seized. Leaders of the women's movement, from Susan B. Anthony to Jane Addams to Alice Paul to Bella Abzug to Flo Kennedy to so many others, spoke out loudly and bravely to demand the rights that we now have. Their courage changed our culture and our laws to the benefit of us all. Looking back, it made no sense for my college friends and me to distance ourselves from the hard-won achievements of earlier feminists. We should have cheered their efforts. Instead, we lowered our voices, thinking the battle was over, and with this reticence, we hurt ourselves. Now I proudly call myself a feminist. If Tip O'Neill were alive today, I might even tell him that I'm a pom-pom girl for feminism. I hope more women and men will join me in accepting this distinguished label. Currently, only 24% of women in the United States say that they consider themselves feminists. Yet when offered a more specific definition of feminism, a feminist is someone who believes in social, political, and economic equality of the sexes. The percentage of women who agree rises to 65%. That's a big move in the right direction. Semantics can be important, but I don't think progress turns on our willingness to apply a label to ourselves. I do think progress turns on our willingness to speak up about the impact gender has on us. We can no longer pretend that biases do not exist, nor can we talk around them. And as Harvard Business School has demonstrated, the result of creating a more equal environment will not just be better performance for our organizations, but quite likely greater happiness for all. Chapter 11. Working Together Toward Equality. I began this book by acknowledging that women in the developed world are better off than ever. But the goal of true equality still eludes us. So how do we move forward? First, we must decide that true equality is long overdue and will be achieved only when more women rise to the top of every government and every industry. Then we have to do the hard work of getting there. All of us, men and women alike, have to understand and acknowledge how stereotypes and biases cloud our beliefs and perpetuate the status quo. Instead of ignoring our differences, we need to accept and transcend them. For decades, we have focused on giving women the choice to work inside or outside the home. We have celebrated the fact that women have the right to make this decision, and rightly so. But we have to ask ourselves if we have become so focused on supporting personal choices that we're failing to encourage women to aspire to leadership. It is time to cheer on girls and women who want to sit at the table, seek challenges, and lean into their careers. Today, despite all of the gains we have made, neither men nor women have real choice. Until women have supportive employers and colleagues, as well as partners who share family responsibilities, they don't have real choice. And until men are fully respected for contributing inside the home, they don't have real choice either. Equal opportunity is not equal unless everyone receives the encouragement that makes seizing those opportunities possible. Only then can both men and women achieve their full potential. None of this is attainable unless we pursue these goals together. Men need to support women, and I wish it went without saying, women need to support women too. Stanford professor Deborah Gruenfeld makes the case. We need to look out for one another, work together, and act more like a coalition. As individuals, we have relatively low levels of power. Working together, we are 50% of the population and therefore have real power. As obvious as this sounds, women have not always worked together in the past. In fact, there are many discouraging examples where women have actually done the opposite. We are a new generation, and we need a new approach. In the summer of 2012, my former Google colleague, Marissa Mayer, was named CEO of Yahoo. Like several of her friends and the Yahoo board, I knew that she was heading into her third trimester of pregnancy. Of course, many men take big jobs when their wives are weeks away from giving birth, and no one raises it as an issue. But Marissa's condition quickly became headline news. She was heralded as the first pregnant CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Feminists cheered. Then Marissa let it be known. My maternity leave will be a few weeks long, and I'll work throughout it. Many feminists stopped cheering. Since taking such a short leave is not feasible or desirable for everyone, they argued that Marissa was hurting the cause by setting up unreasonable expectations. So was this one giant leap forward for womankind and one baby step back? Of course not. Marissa became the youngest CEO of a Fortune 500 company while pregnant. She decided how she wanted to manage her career and family and never claimed that her choice should apply to anyone else. If she had cut Yahoo's maternity leave to 2 weeks for all employees, then concern would have been in order. She did not do this, but she was still roundly criticized. Even a European cabinet member weighed in. Like any individual, Marissa knows best what she is capable of, given her particular circumstances. And as journalist Kara Swisher also noted, Marissa has a husband who can actually take care of the child, and no one seems to remember that. Women who want to take 2 weeks off, or 2 days, or 2 years, or 20 years, deserve everyone's full support. As Marissa's experience demonstrates, women in powerful positions often receive greater scrutiny. Because the vast majority of leaders are men, it is not possible to generalize from any one example. But the dearth of female leaders causes one woman to be viewed as representative of her entire gender. And because people often discount and dislike female leaders, these generalizations are often critical. This is not just unfair to the individuals, but reinforces the stigma that successful women are unlikable. A perfect and personal example occurred in May 2012 when a Forbes blogger posted an article entitled, "Sheryl Sandberg is the Valley's It Girl, just like Kim Pulesi once was." He began his comparison by describing Kim, an early tech entrepreneur, as a luminary in the mid-1990s who never really earned her success, but was in the right place at the right time, and was young, pretty, and a good speaker. The blogger then argued, I think Pelosi is a good cautionary tale for Sheryl Sandberg. Ouch. Kim and I had never met or spoken before this incident, but she defended both of us. In a published response, she described reading the blog post and how her immediate thought was, how sad. How sad that as an industry and a society, we haven't advanced over these past two decades when it comes to views on women and leadership. As with all the past lazy, stereotype-ridden articles like this one, it gets the facts wrong. After correcting the facts, she continued, views like these are all too commonplace and part of a pervasive pattern that belittles, demeans, and marginalizes women as leaders. So many other readers joined her in calling the post sexist that the blogger posted an apology and retraction. I was grateful for Kim's vocal support. The more women can stick up for one another, the better. Sadly, this doesn't always happen. And it seems to happen even less when women voice a position that involves a gender-related issue. The attacks on Marissa for her maternity leave plans came almost entirely from other women. This has certainly been my experience, too. Everyone loves a fight, and they really love a catfight. The media will report endlessly about women attacking other women, which distracts from the real issues. When arguments turn into she said, we all lose. Every social movement struggles with dissension within its ranks, in part because advocates are passionate and unlikely to agree on every position and solution. Betty Friedan famously and foolishly refused to work with, or even to shake hands with, Gloria Steinem. They both did so much to further women's rights. But what if they had been able to work together? Couldn't they have furthered the cause even more? There are so many of us who care deeply about these matters. We should strive to resolve our differences quickly, and when we disagree, stay focused on our shared goals. This is not a plea for less debate, but for more constructive debate. In Marissa's case, it would have been great to keep the focus on her breakthrough achievements. Thanks to her high-profile appointment, other companies might consider hiring pregnant women for big jobs. And expectant mothers might be more inclined to apply for them. By diminishing Marissa's accomplishment, the attacks diminished us all. It is a painful truth that one of the obstacles to more women gaining power has sometimes been women already in power. Women in the generations ahead of me believed, largely correctly, that only one woman would be allowed to ascend to the senior ranks in any particular company. In the days of tokenism, women looked around the room and instead of bonding against an unfair system, they often viewed one another as competition. Ambition fueled hostility, and women wound up being ignored, undermined, and in some cases even sabotaged by other women. In the 1970s, this phenomenon was common enough that the term Queen Bee was used to describe a woman who flourished in a leadership role, especially in male-dominated industries, and who used her position to keep other female worker bees down. For some, it was simple self-preservation. For others, it reflected their coming of age in a society that believed men were superior to women. In this sense, Queen Bee behavior was not just a cause of gender discrimination, but also a consequence of that discrimination. Queen Bees internalized the low status of women, and in order to feel worthy themselves, wanted only to associate with men. Often, these queen bees were rewarded for maintaining the status quo and not promoting other women. Unfortunately, this there can be only one attitude still lingers today. It makes no sense for women to feel that we are competing against one another anymore, but some still do. In certain instances, women question their female colleagues' level of career commitment, aggressiveness, and leadership abilities. One study found that female professors believed that male PhD students were more committed to their careers than female PhD students, even though a survey of the students found no gender difference in their reported levels of commitment. Other research suggests that once a woman achieves success, particularly in a gender-biased context, her capacity to see gender discrimination is reduced. It's heartbreaking to think about one woman holding another back. As former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright once said, "There's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women." And the consequences extend beyond individual pain. Women's negative views of female co-workers are often seen as an objective assessment, more credible than the views of men. When women voice gender bias, they legitimize it. Obviously, a negative attitude cannot be gender-based if it comes from another woman, right? Wrong. Often without realizing it, women internalize disparaging cultural attitudes and then echo them back. As a result, women are not just victims of sexism, they can also be perpetrators. There is hope that this attitude is changing. A recent survey found that high-potential women working in business want to pay it forward, and 73% have reached out to other women to help them develop their talents. Almost all of the women I have encountered professionally have gone out of their way to be helpful. When I was a lowly summer intern at McKinsey, I met Diana Farrell, a star consultant, at a company-wide conference in Colorado. Diana had just spoken at a panel that I attended, and we bumped into each other afterward. Where else? In the women's room. We ended up having a talk that continued beyond the sinks, and she became a close friend and trusted advisor. Years later, she was one of the few who encouraged me to join Google. The more women help one another, the more we help ourselves. Acting like a coalition truly does produce results. In 2004, four female executives at Merrill Lynch started having lunch together once a month. They shared their accomplishments and frustrations. They brainstormed about business. After the lunches, they would all go back to their offices and tout one another's achievements. They couldn't brag about themselves, but they could easily do it for their colleagues. Their careers flourished, and each rose up the ranks to reach managing director and executive officer levels. The queen bee was banished, and the hive became stronger. I know that not every woman encounters this kind of positive female support, and yet, oddly, we often expect it. Most women don't assume that men will reach out and help, but with our own gender, we assume there will be a connection. We imagine women will act communally, and maybe we do so out of our own bias. Once in my career, I felt that a senior woman treated me poorly. She would complain about me and my team behind my back, but would not discuss any concerns she had with me, even when I asked directly. When I first met her, I had high hopes that she would be an ally. When she turned out to be not just unhelpful, but actually spiteful, I was not just disappointed. I felt betrayed. Sharon Mears explained to me that this feeling of betrayal was predictable. Both men and women do, in fact, demand more time and warmth from women in the workplace. We expect greater niceness from women and can become angry when they don't conform to that expectation. I think that's a big part of the protest about executive women being mean to other women, Sharon told me. I think it's about a double standard we have when we look at female versus male superiors. I now recognize that had this senior woman been a man and acted the same way, I still would have been frustrated, but I wouldn't have taken it so personally. It's time to drop the double standard. Gender should neither magnify nor excuse rude and dismissive treatment. We should expect professional behavior and even kindness from everyone. Any coalition of support must also include men, many of whom care about gender inequality as much as women do. In 2012, Kunal Modi, a student at Harvard's Kennedy School, wrote an article imploring men to man up on family and workplace issues. He argued that, for the sake of American corporate performance and shareholder returns, Men must play an active role in ensuring that the most talented young workers, often women, are being encouraged to advocate for their career advancement. So men, let's get involved now, and not in a patronizing manner that marginalizes this as some altruistic act on behalf of our mothers, wives, and daughters, but on behalf of ourselves, our companies, and the future of our country. I applaud Kunal's message, especially his focus on active engagement. Men of all ages must commit to changing the leadership ratios. They can start by actively seeking out qualified female candidates to hire and promote. And if qualified candidates cannot be found, then we need to invest in more recruiting, mentoring, and sponsoring so women can get the necessary experience. An us versus them crusade will not move us toward true equality. Nor will an us versus us crusade, which UC Hastings law professor Joan Williams calls the gender wars. These wars are being waged on many fronts, but the mommy wars, which pit mothers who work outside the home against mothers who work inside the home, attract the most attention. As Professor Williams explains, these mommy wars are so bitter because both groups' identities are at stake because of another clash of social ideals. The ideal worker is defined as someone always available for work, and the good mother is defined as always available to her children. So ideal worker women need to prove that, although they weren't always there, their children are fine, fine, fine. Women who have rejected the ideal worker norm and settled for a slower career, or no career, need to prove that their compromise was necessary for the good of their families. So you have each group of women judging the other, because neither group of women has been able to live up to inconsistent ideals. Professor Williams is absolutely right. One of the conflicts inherent in having choice is that we all make different ones. There is always an opportunity cost, and I don't know any woman who feels comfortable with all her decisions. As a result, we inadvertently hold that discomfort against those who remind us of the path not taken. Guilt and insecurity make us second-guess ourselves and, in turn, resent one another. In a letter to The Atlantic in June 2012, Barnard President Deborah Spar wrote about this messy and complicated emotion, exploring why she and so many successful women feel so guilty. She decided that it's because women have been subtly striving all our lives to prove that we have picked up the torch that feminism provided, that we haven't failed the mothers and grandmothers who made our ambitions possible. And yet, in a deep and profound way, we are failing, because feminism wasn't supposed to make us feel guilty or prod us into constant competitions over who is raising children better, organizing more cooperative marriages, or getting less sleep. It was supposed to make us free, to give us not only choices, but the ability to make these choices without constantly feeling that we'd somehow gotten it wrong. Stay-at-home mothers can make me feel guilty, and at times, intimidate me. There are moments when I feel like they are judging me, and I imagine there are moments when they feel like I am judging them. But when I push past my own feelings of guilt and insecurity, I feel grateful. These parents, mostly mothers, constitute a large amount of the talent that helps sustain our schools, nonprofits, and communities. Remember that mom who pointed out that my son should be wearing a green t-shirt on St. Patrick's Day? She is a tireless volunteer in the classroom and our community. So many people benefit from her hard work. Society has long undervalued the contributions of those who work without a salary. My mother felt this slight keenly. For 17 years, she worked more than full-time as a mother and on behalf of Soviet Jewry. She understood that the compensation for her efforts was making a difference in the lives of persecuted people halfway across the world. But many people in her own neighborhood did not consider her work to be as important as a real job. She was still regarded as Just a housewife. Undercutting the very real but unpaid work of raising children and advocating for human rights. We all want the same thing. To feel comfortable with our choices and to feel validated by those around us. So let's start by validating one another. Mothers who work outside the home should regard mothers who work inside the home as real workers. And mothers who work inside the home should be equally respectful of those choosing another option. A few years ago, on a visit to the U.S. Naval Academy, I met an extraordinary woman who was about to join the U.S. Submarine Force as one of its first female officers. She was nervous about her new role and aware that there were risks in being an officer and not a gentleman. I asked her to let me know how it went. A year later, she followed up with a heartfelt email. "Truthfully, I was prepared for opposition and the possibility of being discounted," she wrote. "But it did not happen. I was respected the moment I stepped on board, and I can truly say that I am a valued part of the crew." Unfortunately, she told me that she encountered resentment from another source, the Navy wives. At an onshore welcome dinner, the wives of her colleagues pounced and accused her of being a bra-burning feminist out to prove a point. They forced her to defend her career choice, reputation, and personal life. "I was shocked. Talk about uncomfortable," she wrote. I did my best to answer their questions and stand my ground. Eventually, they backed off and started in on my husband. We must work harder to rise above this. The gender wars need an immediate and lasting peace. True equality will be achieved only when we all fight the stereotypes that hold us back. Feeling threatened by others' choices pulls us all down. Instead, we should funnel our energy into breaking this cycle. Sharon Mears tells a story about a school parents' night she attended, in which the children introduced their parents. Sharon's daughter Sammy pointed at her father and said, "This is Steve. He makes buildings, kind of like an architect, and he loves to sing." Then Sammy pointed at Sharon and said, "This is Sharon. She wrote a book, she works full-time, and she never picks me up from school." To Sharon's credit, hearing this account did not make her feel guilty. Instead, she said, "I felt mad at the social norms that make my daughter feel odd because her mother doesn't conform to those norms." The goal is to work toward a world where those social norms no longer exist. If more children see fathers at school pickups and mothers who are busy at jobs, both girls and boys will envision more options for themselves. Expectations will not be set by gender, but by personal passion, talents, and interests. I am fully aware that most women are not focused on changing social norms for the next generation, but simply trying to get through each day. 40% of employed mothers lack sick days and vacation leave. And about 50% of employed mothers are unable to take time off to care for a sick child. Only about half of women receive any pay during maternity leave. These policies can have severe consequences. Families with no access to paid family leave often go into debt and can fall into poverty. Part-time jobs with fluctuating schedules offer little chance to plan and often stop short of the 40-hour week that provides basic benefits. Too many work standards remain inflexible and unfair, often penalizing women with children. Too many talented women try their hardest to reach the top and bump up against systemic barriers. So many others pull back because they do not think they have a choice. All of this brings me back to Lema Bowie's insistence that we need more women in power. When leadership insists that these policies change, they will. Google put in pregnancy parking when I asked for it, and it remains there long after I left. We must raise both the ceiling and the floor. My mother had fewer choices than I did, but with my father's support, She has always worked hard. During my childhood, she chose to be a devoted mother and volunteer. When I left for college, she went back to school to study teaching English as a second language. She taught full-time for 15 years and felt that teaching was her calling. At one point, I was asked to become the administrator for the entire school, my mother told me. I said no, preferring to stay in the classroom and work with my students. I was exactly where I wanted to be. In 2003, my mother left the workforce to take care of her ailing parents. She was sorry to leave her teaching career, but family has always been her top priority. After my grandparents passed away, she re-entered the workforce. She founded Earpiece, Save Your Hearing, a nonprofit to prevent noise-induced hearing loss in young people. At the age of 65, she has returned to her love of teaching, running workshops and speaking to students from elementary to high school. My mother has leaned in her entire life. She raised her children, helped her parents spend their final years in dignity and comfort, and continues to be a dedicated and loving wife, mother, and grandmother. She has always contributed to her community and the world. She is my inspiration. My mother wants to see society achieve true equality. She sees the barriers that women still face, but she also sees new opportunities. She believes that what I have achieved and much more is possible for many others. I agree. And more important, so many women that I have encountered agree. Filled with energy, optimism, and self-confidence, they are scrambling along that jungle gym and moving toward their long-term dream. It's up to us to end the self-fulfilling belief that women can't do this, women can't do that. Throwing up our hands and saying it can't be done ensures that it will never be done. I have written this book to encourage women to dream big, forge a path through the obstacles, and achieve their full potential. I am hoping that each woman will set her own goals and reach for them with gusto. And I am hoping that each man will do his part to support women in the workplace and in the home, also with gusto. As we start using the talents of the entire population, our institutions will be more productive, our homes will be happier, and the children growing up in those homes will no longer be held back by narrow stereotypes. I know that for many women, getting to the top of their organization is far from their primary focus. My intention is not to exclude them or ignore their valid concerns. I believe that if more women lean in, we can change the power structure of our world and expand opportunities for all. More female leadership will lead to fairer treatment for all women. Shared experience forms the basis of empathy, and in turn, can spark the institutional changes we need. Critics have scoffed at me for trusting that once women are in power, they will help one another, since that has not always been the case. I'm willing to take that bet. The first wave of women who ascended to leadership positions were few and far between, and to survive, many focused more on fitting in than on helping others. The current wave of female leadership is increasingly willing to speak up. The more women attain positions of power, the less pressure there will be to conform, and the more they will do for other women. Research already suggests that companies with more women in leadership roles have better work-life policies, smaller gender gaps in executive compensation, and more women in mid-level management. The hard work of generations before us means that equality is within our reach. We can close the leadership gap now. Each individual's success can make success a little easier for the next. We can do this for ourselves, for one another, for our daughters, and for our sons. If we push hard now, this next wave can be the last wave. In the future, There will be no female leaders. There will just be leaders. When Gloria Steinem marched in the streets to fight for the opportunities that so many of us now take for granted, she quoted Susan B. Anthony, who marched in the streets before her and concluded, "Our job is not to make young women grateful. It is to make them ungrateful so they keep going." The sentiment remains true today. We need to be grateful for what we have, but dissatisfied with the status quo. This dissatisfaction spurs the charge for change. We must keep going. The march toward true equality continues. It continues down the halls of governments, corporations, academia, hospitals, law firms, nonprofits, research labs, and every organization, large and small. We owe it to the generations that came before us and the generations that will come after to keep fighting. I believe women can lead more in the workplace. I believe men can contribute more in the home. And I believe that this will create a better world, one where half our institutions are run by women and half our homes are run by men. I look toward the world I want for all children and my own. My greatest hope is that my son and my daughter will be able to choose what to do with their lives without external or internal obstacles slowing them down or making them question their choices. If my son wants to do the important work of raising children full-time, I hope he is respected and supported. And if my daughter wants to work full-time outside her home, I hope she is not just respected and supported, but also liked for her achievements. I hope they both end up exactly where they want to be. And when they find where their true passions lie, I hope they both lean in all the way. Let's keep talking. My goal is that this book is not the end of the conversation, but the beginning. I invite you to continue the discussion with me by joining the Lean In community at www.facebook.com/leanin.org. Let's keep talking about these issues and supporting one another. Women and men of all ages are welcome. I also encourage you to visit www.leanin.org for practical education and personal experiences that can help you reach your goals. Here you can explore topics critical to your success, from negotiating effectively to understanding your strengths. You also can create and join Lean In Circles, small peer groups that meet in person for ongoing encouragement and development. This is Elisa Donovan. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead, by Sheryl Sandberg with Nell Scovell. This program was directed by Jessica Kay. Executive Producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2013 by Lean In Foundation. Production copyright 2013, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.